some cases many years. Basically, it's super disorganized. So if you want to understand quantum mechanics, decoherence, open systems, a lot of times you start reading in the literature and they keep referring to quantum Brownian motion as kind of a key testbed model. And if you go look that up, you go get something like the Caldera-Leggett model, and you end up with something that looks like this. You open up the paper and you're like, wow, the first thing to understand the quantum classical transition and decoherence, and I'm looking at an equation like this. This is very awful. And even though you could spend a little bit of time, all this actually ends up making sense, and it all has a very intuitive meaning if you pour through the papers. This is the kind of thing you initially confront, and there's just no reason it has to look like this. So I am going to try to convince you that the way everybody teaches this stuff is wrong. They should teach it the way I like to think about it. So I'm basically just going to do that and try to do quantum Brownian motion done right, or done the simple way. Actually, let's go all the way to the top. Okay. So I'm going to start off with a question that's going to backtrack and say is, why are harmonic oscillators ubiquitous? Okay. We study them all the time. It's like the first thing you learn in every new branch of physics. You introduce a new formalism, you apply it to the harmonic oscillator, right? Well, in classical mechanics, it's very easy to state what makes the harmonic oscillator ubiquitous. And it basically just derives from an assumption that your Hamiltonian on phase space is smooth on phase space, so that you can expand it in something like this. And again, this is all instructive, so please stop me. And this is the first time I've given this talk, so please stop me if with questions and all that kind of stuff. Okay? And so you expand your arbitrary Hamiltonian out. You start getting terms that look like this. Okay? And so we just say, okay, well, this is an arbitrary expansion of an arbitrary Hamiltonian. This is some energy offset. It makes no physical difference. These two terms we can eliminate through a smart choice of coordinates. And so the first kind of non-trivial set of terms that you get are these guys. For any Hamiltonian that's smooth, if you're looking on a close scale. So what happens if we just say that we're looking close enough that we can ignore all these higher order terms and we're just going to concentrate on this guy? Okay, so we just get, well, I'm just not going to write it again. We're just going to get something that looks like that. And the nice thing about this is that not only is it always there because everything looks like this if you zoom in close enough, but this Hamiltonian is exactly solvable. So if we start with a case where H11 is equal to 0, so this cross term is equal to 0. This is just the standard harmonic oscillator. You put this in phase space, and I'm going to be drawing lots of phase space in this plot. And the trajectories obviously just look like ellipses, where these the ratio between these is set by the relative size of these terms. Okay, and everything's very simple. If H11 is non-zero, you can do one of two things. You can either just solve it for that particular case, which again just looks like this, or you can just, as that suggests, you can just eliminate it right by changing coordinates, rotating. So you go from xp to some new x prime p prime, which is just some rotation of your original coordinates. And you can use this to eliminate that term. So everything with a smooth Hamiltonian looks like this as long as you're looking in close. Usually we end up choosing, we'll say that this is 1/2 m omega squared, and this is 1/2 m. We call that the mass, we call that the frequency. But those are really just words that we can apply to any system that looks like this. In the quantum case, we want a Hamiltonian that limits to some classical theory. And so we expect that we get a similar expansion. Actually, I might just think and just put on hats on all this stuff. You hit your first kind of wrinkle in that the these all have unambiguous kind of classical limits, but this term does not. But of course, it actually doesn't really matter, because you can always, anything that's going to limit classically to something that's x hat b hat is either going to look like a combination of x hat with any commutator. So say I call that h11 plus h11 prime, the commutator. But of course, we know that this is ih bar, so it's just something that's constant. Or if h11 is was going to be real, if you try to make that real, this would be imaginary, so it can't be part of a Hamiltonian. So this is really the only thing that you can have for that cross term. And then, of course, we can solve this exactly, right? So if we write this down in the, looking for the, evolution of the density matrix, it looks something like this. So here is something that I'm going to be working with in this talk, is what I don't know if there's a great definite words for it, but I'm just going to call this, these are symplectic indices. They are just indices that run over x and p. And alpha I'm going to use as a general phase space coordinate. So alpha is x hat p hat. Okay. And the nice thing about this notation is that, as you can see in this expansion, we're only basing this on kind of the smoothness in phase space, which is to say it's nice properties and symplectic structure. And this kind of a expression for our arbitrary quadratic Hamiltonian respects that. More formally, what it does is if we consider the class of dynamics with arbitrary real values of HAB, then this class of dynamics the class of dynamics is held is invariant under a symplectic transformation, a linear symplectic transformation. So a linear symplectic transformation is a arbitrary call this y alpha equals alpha prime. Which I'm going to just do this classically for right now. Yeah. Y here is a arbitrary linear operator, except that it has to conserve the symplectic form. So that's going to look like, there we go. So you can write this in a couple different ways. But here, the symplectic form is being played by the Levi-Civita tensor. OK? Right. And so now, if we do a symplectic transformation, it says, OK, we're going to change our coordinates. We're just going to do some sort of linear transformation of the coordinates. As long as our set of dynamics has this form where all of the symplectic indices are contracted with each other, then the equation remains in the same form even after the transformation. So this is totally just like Lorentz covariance. And the behavior of these guys is just like if you know in field theory, if you're using, excuse me, vial indices. Mathematically, they have the exact same property.
Yeah. Vary over what kind of set, like what is the...
So here, I'm literally just talking about a single continuous quantum degree of freedom. Is that the question? So...
They are parameterized by some continuous parameters or something like this, yes? Because you have substituted the classical theory by this formulation by operators, yes?
Yeah.
And those alphas, I understand they kind of are just a nice form of writing x and p as operators.
Yes. Yeah, so alpha is just a vector, you know, in phase space. It's a two-dimensional vector, yeah.
But those are still operators, yeah? So they vary through the subset of operators, yeah? Like, these are coordinates on some space.
Yeah. So the space is x and p. This is clearly just my mistake. I'm sorry. Keep going.
So the point is that I'm just wondering, like, what are like two different elements of the space explicitly or something like that? Because like this operator x, yeah, is it like assumed just to be parameterized by some continuous real parameter, or like what is the variability of this operator?
Somebody help me.
You mean what space is it acting in? What Hilbert space is it acting in? Are you asking is there some deformation parameter like h bar that?
Yeah, like what is the class of those x's that are
so classically x is a real number.
Yeah.
Right, and so this is we're just working in the Hilbert space if you want of square integrable functions.
So there's like fixed dimension. Space, it's like fixed Hilbert space in the background, and we just consider like all possible self-adjoint operators that have specific commutation relations.
Yeah, I mean, if you want, you can. I'm just going to be concentrating on all of this. Will extend to you know, this is definitely going to be continuous degrees of freedom. But this right now we're just working with a single quantum continuous degree of freedom. So if you want, you can just imagine in the background that the representation we're working with is the square integrable functions over the real line.
Schrodinger.
Wait. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. Good. So. More formally, when you do write the symplectic transformation, you take something that has, I guess I'll just write down a arbitrary matrix with a bunch of indices. And this gets sent to under Y. I think this is going to be the upper indices with inverses. I may lose track of these things. This will be B, this will be B prime, and we'll have that clear? Okay. So these are just like change of coordinates when you're doing a Lorentz transformation. Good. Okay, now, besides being ubiquitous, the important thing about this class of dynamics is that it's exactly solvable. And I think the way I'm going to concentrate on this talk is we're going to actually switch over to the Wigner representation. So we're going to be working with Wigner functions. And that's going to make our connection with classical mechanics and the quantum classical transition a lot more intuitive.
Can you lower the very top board a little bit because somehow it's all under glare? I can't read.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about that top board just because I'm never going to make a reference to it again in the talk. It was just to make you go, oh, I don't want to understand that. That was the yeah. So if you look at that and you say, boy, I do want to understand that. You know, you can leave. Okay. Right. Now, what you'll often see the Wigner function introduced in a, I'm going to get the normalization wrong here, in a very I'm going to get all my numbers wrong, so we're going to say, I guess we want delta x, it's going to be delta x times p, and then there's going to be x plus delta x over 2 rho, x minus delta x over 2, something like this, in some very ugly non-symplectic covariant form. But if you look at most modern papers, they tend to introduce it like this because most people don't like the Wigner function that much and don't use it very much. But of course, way back in the day, when it was originally introduced, and still when it's done correctly, you can. So this is for a, well, we'll say for an arbitrary operator. It just takes this very simple form. Okay, and so what this operator is it's the phase space. It's a phase space displacement operator. So that if you compute expectation values of things like x and p for a particular operator or a particular state, if the operator we're talking about is a density matrix, then under that phase space translation, those expectation values will shift as you would expect.
What's that? Maybe a mistake, but it looks like you've written down the Fourier transform.
Oh, yeah. Right. So you can call this. All right, and in this representation, we can completely solve this model in a way that basically allows us to use our classical intuition very quickly and very strongly. So the classical equations of motion are just this, where for the case of the harmonic oscillator, this is the one I'm going to be calling H. Okay, so. Right? When we look up here, if there's no kind of off-diagonal term, so it's just an x squared plus p squared, we just have this form. We are going to do just a little bit of index gymnastics, but it's not going to be like a GR class. Okay, we're going to get this. It's this off-diagonal generator that's basically going to act. It's that's what's going to give you the rotations in phase space. So it's just going to be like if this was a, you know, a basically theta, and you're just going to rotate in phase space. Okay, and so this totally describes the classical dynamics, but of course it works. This is the simple. This is with I guess the H11 term equals zero. But of course you can just stick in diagonal terms. You end up with a skewed harmonic oscillator, and this these equations of motion still work. So if m and omega are real, as we said, you just get something that looks like this. If omega is imaginary, you get what is sometimes called an upside down harmonic oscillator. You get hyperbolas instead of ellipses. Yeah. You get that kind of behavior. And again, if you have diagonal terms, you end up doing something like this. Okay. And so the really nice thing about the Wigner function is that the solution is super intuitive. Okay, and so what this says is that if you want to know what the Wigner function is at some time t at a particular location in phase space, you just take that location in phase space, evolve it backwards by the equations of motion, and ask what the initial Wigner function was. Okay, so if you were a minimal uncertainty wave packet, and you were kind of concentrated in an area like this, some distance from the origin, and you're on a simple harmonic motion, so you're moving that way, then at a time later, like each of these points is just mapped point for point according to the classical equations of motion. If this thing has a, if your initial state had some sort of weird blip, so you were not in a minimal uncertainty wave packet, it would just rotate around exactly like you would expect. That's not that great, but I think you get what I'm saying. And if we wanted to be a little bit more abstract, the way we could write this is to eliminate the functional dependence, or just suppress it, I guess. And I'm going to use this open circle to denote composition. And this is just going to be a stand-in for the function on phase space that applies this matrix to alpha. Does that make sense? Okay. Okay. So that's the simple harmonic oscillator. So now we're going to move to open quantum systems. So first, just like we asked, why are simple harmonic oscillators ubiquitous? Why in open quantum systems are CP maps ubiquitous? And the reason for this, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways where you can motivate the form of a CP map. The one I find most intuitive is that they represent the most general possible discrete in time Markovian evolution of an open quantum system, which with no initial correlation, so kind of the simplest possible state. So you start with any arbitrary density matrix. You start with an arbitrary environment without loss of generality. You can just consider the environment to be pure. You can always just expand it to a some purifying environment. Yeah. Okay, so that's how the whole thing evolves under an arbitrary unitary. The density matrix itself goes to this. And here I is a arbitrary basis for the environment. Okay, so these are the Krauss operators of the CP map. You just take it. This is right. The unitary here is an operator on both the system and the environment. You sandwich it between two environmental states, and so now it's just an operator on the system, and you end up with this kind of map. So anything that looks like this, or anything that you think you can approximate well like this, CP maps are going to be ubiquitous. What's often not appreciated really well, and unfortunately I can't derive in this talk, but I will link you to great notes, is that the Lindblad equation is just a infinitesimal form of this. Okay, and so I just encourage you to go, if you haven't seen this before, I think it's caves, right? Not calves? Carlton calves? Caves? Caves, good. Okay. Yeah, sorry. So he has some great notes on his website. You know, he's just got like a list of 20 notes, and one of them is written like this. But what it's very easy to see is that basically, in order to have a differential map, so in order, you say you have your CP map, but it's continuous in time. And if you want this to nicely limit to basically the identity superoperator for small times, then these, as a function of time, have to either go like root t or the identity minus something proportional to t. And you break those up into a few different ways, and you end up just recovering the Lindblad equation. I think these are going to be much the same. Okay. So just like CP maps are everywhere in open quantum systems, anytime you have a Markovian evolution of a system that's initially uncorrelated with a part of the environment it's operating in, likewise, if that happens in a smooth way, then you will end up with a Lindblad equation. Okay, now the thing about this is, and the important caveat, is that the Lindblad equation can't be physical. It can't be strictly physical. It can't be an exact equation because it generates entropy at first order in time. And so I'm trying to think if I got time for this. I'm going to skip giving you the example, but I will just describe it in words. If you start out with something really simple, a two-state system, and you kind of have the Lindblad equation be the simplest possible case where it's sort of measuring, or it's, you know, it's measuring in the you start off with an initial pure state, and it's measuring in some basis that doesn't commute with that, you will see that the off-diagonal terms, say rho looks like this. Have this sort of behavior, okay? And so that as soon as you have just a little bit of infinitesimal amount of time, you immediately have entanglement. But this can never be exactly true, and the reason is that if you start off in a initially untangled state, entanglement can only form at second order in time.
The first time you said entropy, is there an equivalence?
Between entanglement and entropy?
Yeah, the direct
equivalence. Yeah, right. Well, I mean, there is a so if you have a well, certainly with a two-state system, right? There's only one parameter that describes all. Yeah, they end up. Entanglement is a more general idea. There's many different forms of entanglement. Entropy is one way to measure it, and for the two-state system, there's a monotonic relationship between the two of them. Okay. So let's use it. Okay. And so what's going on? So the reason this can never be exact is because anytime you're basically looking for an application of a CP map infinitesimally, what you're talking about doing is, right, that the CP map is you apply a unitary, so it evolves the thing forward a little bit, and you trace out the environment. And if you're applying this CP map again and again and again, if it kind of forms a dynamical semigroup, you bring in the new auxiliary environment, you apply that same unitary, and then you trace it out again. And if you're kind of reducing, you know, you're trying to make this infinitesimal, so the amount of time you're applying it for gets smaller and smaller and smaller, there still has to be some sort of interaction time. And so the one I always keep in my head is if your system is some heavy particle and it's being bombarded by a gas, there is going to be some finite time scale over which the particle is interacting with the system. And so it's here where formally the entanglement only grows quadratically in time. So if you draw the entanglement, what it'll look like, it'll look like something that does this. And then if the system goes away, it kind of flattens out again in time. So this is the entanglement. And it'll do something that like this on every scattering event. And if you kind of smooth over that time scale, you get something that looks linear.
Long compared to the direction time.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. So what that means is that you
can never treat the Lindblad equation as some sort of like totally fundamental dynamical equation. Unlike the Caldera-Leggett equation, which in principle can be, you know, it's an exact model, right? The problem you'll find, and here I'm going to make reference to that equation even though I told you I wouldn't, the problem you'll find is, what's that? Sure thing. That's what we want. That. What ends up happening is you declare some specific model of your environment. So in this case, you'll have a central system oscillator, say, which is Caldera-Leggett, and then you have a bunch of environments, all weakly coupled to it, starting out in some initial temperature. And so the entropy will grow like it's supposed to grow initially quadratic in time. But you can have all sorts of crazy time dependence as this thing evolves along. And this will, in general, all these different parameters will come in at different times and have all sorts of different behavior depending on the temperature of the environment, how it compares to the frequency of the oscillator, how the distribution of the oscillators in the environment are what they're like. And it'll introduce a million different complications that are important to know exist, but really obscure the basics. Okay, so basically what we're going to do is we're going to,
since you did talk on it. Yeah. Isn't the full equation should be somehow non-local in time too, or, I mean, it's not.
I think it's buried in the time of
density. You've hidden it all in the H, so that's for some particular choice of the initial state.
Yes.
The difference, the choice of initial state.
Exactly.
These, gamma and so on would be different.
Absolutely. Yep.
So it's not truly the evolution equation in some sense.
It's
describing the evolution of one particular state, but it's not something that you could plug in any initial state and get.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And it's in that sense it's another, because we're going to show that in the limit that the Lindblad equation applies, all of those complications disappear. The fact that you're keeping track of them is quite a distraction. Yeah, no, please. I really appreciate it.
In some sense, it's not, think you're doing an injustice to the Lindblad equipment. You're saying it couldn't be fundamental, blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, all of this is non-relativistic. It couldn't be fundamental, too. I mean, you're always making some approximation of others. So
that's right.
Not true that there's some regime in which the Lindblad equation...
That's absolutely true.
It's fundamental. It'd be like saying Brownian motion could not be fundamental because particles have inertia, and it's ignoring inertia.
You're
always ignoring something.
That's fair. I guess what I would say is that if you think about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, like, there's always something you can throw out, but non-relativistic quantum mechanics seems to be a thing that, yes, we're formally ignoring relativistic effects, we're formally ignoring gravity, all these other things, but on those terms, it's internally consistent, right? The Lindblad equation, sure, it's internally consistent in some sense, but it's very limited and specific. I think it's a very similar situation to friction in classical mechanics, right? The frictionless classical mechanics is kind of a huge formalism that is internally self-consistent. If you want to do friction-full classical mechanics, this works, but all sorts of things start breaking because basically you have these hidden degrees of freedom that can suck in energy and do all these things. The Lindblad equation functions just like that, I think. Is that fair enough?
Yeah.
Okay. But I totally agree. Yeah. Okay, so the idealization then that we want when we, I think that folks want when they say quantum Brownian motion is to do the same thing. So up here we said, what is the most general Hamiltonian we can take? Where we expand it, we just say, we're just going to look locally, so we're going to throw out those terms, and then we can solve this exactly. In the same way, quantum Brownian motion in full symplectic generality is going to come from taking this equation, expanding it, and solving it just like that. And there's an exact solution, just like there was in the closed system case. All right. So ideal quantum Brownian motion is time continuous, Markovian, open system evolution, and so we're going to do the same thing. So we take the Hamiltonian, we say this is going to be if I have to come back to those, probably not. If you don't mind, I'm going to move the index upstairs. And so just like we're going to say that this is 1 half h a b alpha hat a alpha hat b, we're going to ignore the higher order terms. And this, you can see that if the Lindblad, any terms in the, oh, and I'm, no, that's actually not. Yeah, I'm trying to think about this. No, it's not totally clear. The linear terms end up not mattering, but I didn't make that totally obvious. I'll leave that as an exercise to the reader that these are the things we're going to care about. And so the Lindblad operator is just going to be expressed like this. Okay? Where now this was a real matrix. In general, these coefficients defining each of the Lindblad operators, their index by I, are complex numbers.
Okay, and then we can write this. Let me put this up at the... Okay. And so you can look at this for a while and you do some reorganizing. And eventually, if you're clever, you change variables as so. Okay, I'll explain this in a second. That allows us to rewrite this equation. And obviously that requires a little bit of algebra and pushing things around, but there's no serious tricks. It works just as you would expect. Okay, so what is so nice about this is that, let's see, I'm going to go that all the way to the top. That we can immediately, or not immediately, but when can check that this solves, or that rather, first that we're going to write down the corresponding dynamics for the Wigner function. Okay, and here the differential is acting on both alpha and the Wigner function. So if you want, you can write it like this. But it doesn't really matter. And I think I must have abbreviated before, but just to make sure it's clear. Okay. And as promised, Oh, right. So the first thing to notice about this before we write down the solution is that this is absolutely identical in form to, I guess, what's called the Klein-Cramer's form of the dynamical equation for a phase space, a classical phase-space probability distribution of a classical particle in Brownian motion. So even though this Wigner function is not anything, it's not a probability distribution, it can be negative depending on the state of the system, the dynamical equation that it obeys, considered as a function in phase space, is exactly the same as the most symplectically general form of quantum Brownian motion, of a classical particle. And of course, you can check that if you set d and gamma to 0, this just reduces to a simple harmonic oscillator. All right, so now let me write down the solution. And just like over on the other side, when I used H, it's this choice of one raised index and one lowered index is what I'm going to abbreviate as a matrix K, which is different than the guy lower down there. Good. Okay, so let me explain what this is. Okay, so this is denotes composition, like I said before. This is literally just multiplying. This is going to maintain normalization. So it's just like you take a, you know, when I apply it to the Wigner function, it literally means I just multiply the value of the Wigner function in all the places. This right here, right, is a convolution. So the convolution over phase space. Okay, and this is a Gaussian in phase space with a covariance matrix set by C, right? So if you want to define a Gaussian in the two-dimensional phase space, it basically can always be defined by an ellipse in phase space, and you have to specify, in this case, the ellipse is going to be centered on the origin, but you have to specify the kind of orientation of the ellipse. And so C has those parameters. Okay, so first of all, let's try to read off an interpretation of these things. It's pretty easy. So D is the classical diffusion matrix. You can see that pretty quickly just by looking at this dynamical equation. When you know, D is big, or when you can ignore these terms, right? This is just the second derivative. If you just were looking at, say, the dxx term, this is the second derivative. So if the growth of the function at a point is proportional to its second derivative, that means it's spreading out anything that's curved. And you can also see this from the fact that for small t, GC is about equal to T times C is just equal to T times D. Oh, you know what? I forgot to put that. Okay, so that as for a fixed amount of time, as D gets larger, this covariance matrix gets smaller. That means that this exponential falls off more slowly, which means that when you convolve the outcome with this this Gaussian, it is smoothing over things more quickly. As D goes to zero, this Gaussian just becomes a delta function. And there's no smoothing effect at all. And then finally, in general, you can just write down your arbitrary D matrix. D up, up, like so. Okay. If I change coordinates, that makes sense. I can eliminate. Just say I choose coordinates that, again, just like C, I can represent D as some matrix that corresponds to an ellipse. I can change coordinates so that it's square. And then I get something like this. What happens then is that this controls basically how fast you're diffusing in one direction, the x direction in the basis that diagonalizes the D matrix, and this controls in the P direction. So that if you start out with some Wigner function that's sitting over here, in general, the dx term will spread it out this way. The dp term will spread it out like that. Okay. Finally, the last free parameter in this general equation is gamma. Gamma is the dissipation rate. So let's talk about these classical, right? We say e to the minus t k is equal to e to the minus gamma t e to the minus h t. All right, so this is, when we're thinking about the classical equations of motion, gamma is just some scalar, h is whatever your basic harmonic motion. So for positive gamma, the classical trajectories just follow the standards equations of motion and then spiral in if you have positive gamma, right? So instead of going like this, you collapse down to the center.
Sorry, I can't read this very well. In your equation for W,
yep.
Is gamma implicit in K or something?
It's right up when I define K.
Once you know K, then you don't need furthermore.
So in order to fully describe this set of dynamics, you need to know H, the harmonic motion. You need to know D, and you need to know gamma. And then from that, you can define K. So K is just a combination of H and gamma.
And is gamma just a number?
Gamma is a real number.
Just a real number, but the. Yes, I see.
Man, 5 minutes left. Oh, there's so much beautifulness left. Okay, and then really quickly, what can I say about, right, so this is a restriction that for these arbitrary, remember, the whole point of this was that we were just doing an arbitrary expansion of Lindblad operators in terms of an expansion in X and P. Just by looking at this definition of D and gamma, you can derive this restriction just mathematically. But of course, this restriction has a very sensible interpretation because if you were to set D to zero and you had positive gamma, right? So D goes to zero, this goes away. If you have positive gamma, what this means is that when you're calculating your new Wigner function as time goes on, the Wigner function is collapsing, right? And so what that would mean is that kind of no matter how spread out your initial state was, it would get sucked all the way to the origin and violate the uncertainty principle. So this is exactly what enforces the uncertainty principle. There has to be some amount of spreading for any amount of cooling that you have. And then so what you find is that instead of everything collapsing to a point, it just goes down and occupies that H bar size ground state. Okay, so I'm going to go for, oh man, I'm just going to write down, there's fun things, I could talk about this all day, but I'm just going to write down, literally list them, these special cases that you may have seen of various things that are associated with quantum Brownian motion that are literally just special choices of those variables. So we have a damped harmonic oscillator, right? So this is gamma greater than zero. Let's see, there's going to be D for some D naught, where this has to obey that restriction. So basically, D naught has to be greater than gamma. So that's the damped harmonic oscillator. H being a harmonic oscillator. Pure spatial decoherence. Which is the exact same thing, and was not obvious to me, as pure momentum diffusion, classically, is the case when H equals zero, gamma equals zero, and D equals only one term in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, you can see that this gives you spatial decoherence because you throw everything else out and you just look like this. Which, if you move to the position representation, looks like rho naught this is getting small, but I think you will get the idea. You just get the off-diagonal terms suppressed. And I will just say this next one out loud because I want to let you guys go. The other thing you can get out of this is you can get a normal drag. So if you want to have friction, so just a really simple friction term that's proportional to velocity, if you can get that by just appropriate choice of these guys. If you then include a momentum diffusion term, you get the Einstein, what was the other guy whose name is attached to it? Smolchowski? Yeah, thanks. Appreciate it. So generally what happens there is, you can formally treat it with P and X, and if you solve the equations, the distribution of P saturates, and then X just spreads out, and you kind of ignore P, integrate over it, say I can't measure P, it just sits in some range, and then I just watch in position space as the thing moves around. So if you look in phase space, no matter where you start out, if you start out with a high-speed particle, it falls down into this range and then just continuously spreads out, and it has that x squared proportional to t, dependence of kind of the classical Brownian motion. So there's a bunch of special cases, and everything you've ever heard called Brownian motion generally looks like that, or it has a bunch of additional factors that are idiosyncratic to the model, and I think are very distracting on the first go. So I think this is the way everyone should think about it. Okay, questions? Yeah.
So first, I just wanted some clarification about what your main thesis is. So are you saying that although there are more general forms for a Lindblad equation describing quantum Brownian motion, this one is kind of analogous to a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian insofar as it's very simple, and furthermore, it maps onto the classical problem nicely.
Yeah.
So that's the claim, that this is a particularly simple kind of quantum Brownian motion as opposed to this is ubiquitous, like all Brownian motion in the quantum world should be described this way.
Well, I guess what I would say is that you choose a small number of idealizing assumptions. So it's Markovian, it's kind of linearized. You can just expand in X and P. You want something that's time continuous. And then insofar as those assumptions hold, it all has to look like this. And it's got a complete exact solution. And it has all of the key properties. You can actually talk about the fluctuation dissipation relation really nicely in this situation. It just has all the nice properties, and it's totally solvable. And it's solvable in a way where you can directly map your classical intuition onto the solution. You can interpret what all the parts are. Whereas, before I had, they literally called this, I don't know what anti-friction is, but that's what that is often known as. And of course, you can find all of these different parts, right? And there's some limit where these things, after an initial, you let the system settle down, right? There's if you have an actual bath, there's like an initial time when all this weird stuff happens right at the beginning, and then all the transients die out. Assuming you're in a certain regime, and these things become approximately constant in time, and then you can start mapping this to these intuitive pieces. But this is really, I think, the nice idealized framework to which kind of everything else is just a. This is the Platonic ideal.
So here's a question, Lee. So Hudson's theorem says that the only pure quantum states that are going to have positive Lee representation everywhere are those that are Gaussian configuration space.
Pure states, yes.
Yep. And then you could ask, well, what's the most general set of Hamiltonians that keeps me in the set of states for which the Lee representation is positive? And the answer will come back, only those Hamiltonians that have the most Debye dependence. And then you could ask the following question, which is, what's the most general form of Lindblad, open system dynamics that keeps all the Gaussian pure quantum states as Gaussian pure quantum states? Because that's the most general form where you'd expect a classical description, right? If you start with a positive Wigner representation, it'll remain positive. So you know that the way you represent that is going to have to be have a classical counterpart. So I'm just sort of curious that whether this could, I mean, this seems like a natural candidate for the most general form of evolution that will keep me classical. And I was just wondering if you thought about that. I mean, perhaps there are other terms you could add that would still admit a classical analog.
I see.
If you add higher order, I mean, didn't you just say if you had higher order terms, if it's, or maybe you're only applying for the Hamiltonian.
But it's not clear that if you put in higher order terms into your Lindblad operators, you would necessarily depart.
I see. My very strong intuition is that you would depart, but I
don't have a way to show that off the top of my head.
It would be nice to show that, because then you would sort of complete the story and say these are the necessary and sufficient conditions for staying within a classical subset.
I mean, I like this actually more because it allows me to think, it allows me to kind of, I can apply this to non-classical states, right? And I can very cleanly understand what happens if I have an initial spatial superposition and how that decoheres very, very nicely here. But and that would be a nice tight result.
Share
hand
for a second.
Yeah. So I guess a related question. I don't know. Converse. I'm not quite sure what it is, but if you, I mean, you've given us the equation, the solution in closed form for the, well, just the diffusion equation for the Wigner function. But maybe you can remind us. I mean, the Wigner function is something in general, something less than the density matrix. One really wants to know, I mean, I guess you have it there too, an equation for the evolution of the density matrix. So to what extent is this Wigner function equation controlling the evolution of the density matrix?
Good. So excellent question. And it was one of these things where I had like two pieces of paper on it, and I was just looking at the time, and it wasn't going to make sense. So what you need to know about the Wigner function is that not every normalizable state over phase space. Right, so Wigner function is a normalizable function over phase space, a real valued function over phase space. Not all of those map to a density matrix, but if they do map to a density matrix, it's unique. So the set of Wigner functions corresponding to an honest density matrix is weird and is actually not specified in the literature. People don't know. But within that set, it's one-to-one. And so the Wigner function is really it's just another representation of quantum mechanics. And in fact, if you want to do anything that exploits symplectic symmetry, the Wigner function is the way to go. Because when you're working with the density matrix, you're working with position representation or momentum representation or whatever. I think the Wigner function is highly underutilized. And there's one other thing for the other key piece of intuition about the Wigner function is I can define a generalized Q function of a state. So this is, again, it's going to be a phase-based representation of the state as so. Oh, sorry, and I want to do... Right, so I'm going to say that psi alpha is the alpha translated version of psi. Psi is an arbitrary state in the Hilbert space. As long as it's localized in phase space, it has to go to zero sufficiently quickly. And this is, yeah. The p function is described in kind of the analogous way. What am I doing here? Wait, I'm messing this up. What am I missing?
Psi is a pure space.
What's that?
Psi was a pure space.
Yes, psi is a pure state, that's right. This is what I want, good.
P of alpha, that's P rho, psi alpha. Okay, so the P function, there's a lot you can say about the one-to-oneness of the P function, but assume it's essentially unique for specifying rho. So you can go from rho to a unique P function, where it's basically a probability distribution over this expansion. And likewise, so this is kind of the preparation side, and this is kind of the measurement side. So these are other phase-based representations. The amazing thing about this is that Q is just the Wigner function, and I don't remember what, I think this is, I think this is the Weyl transform of this state. So you take the Wigner function, you convolve it with something that's characteristic of psi, but this has no psi dependence. You get this, and you get the exact kind of symmetric relationship with this. So basically, you know, there's a whole class of Q Q functions. The most general one people use is when they take psi to be the coherent state centered at the origin. But you can define them all like this. And the Wigner function is kind of this convolutionary mean between the Q and the P function. And it doesn't depend on psi, the state you used. So that's the sense in which I think this gives you the best intuition about what the phase space structure of the Wigner function tells you about psi. It tells you if I make a measurement, you know, in this basis, I could talk a lot about that. I didn't present it very clearly. I'm sorry.
What is this called?
So this is the Husini Q function. This is the Sudarshan.
Sudarshan. George Sudarshan.
Yeah, and sometimes they who was the guy who did all the coherent states?
Glauber.
Yeah, the Sudarshan Glauber P function. So the Wigner function is a very, very special phase-based representation of in quantum mechanics. Whereas these involve some sort of choice of scale. So if you're doing quantum optics, it can make sense to work. The Husini Q function will have nice properties when you choose the coherent state that has the ground state width of the oscillator you're actually working with. But these kind of are specific to the particular system you're talking about, whereas the Wigner function is unique in that sense.
So this equation has some magical property. You said that not every Wigner function comes from a density measure.
That's right. I wouldn't call it a Wigner function if it didn't come from a density measure.
Every
normalizable function over phase space, right. Real function, comes from a density measure.
And one doesn't know exactly what the set is.
Yeah,
this equation preserves that set, whatever.
Exactly.
So does that help you figure out what the set is?
I don't think so. This has been known since a long time. So this has been known for a long time, since the 80s, I think, at least, and maybe beforehand. This solution was written down for various special cases that people had analyzed for a while. This kind of symplectically general version of it actually wasn't until like 2004 or something. It didn't require any, people had this explosion of, you know, they didn't bundle everything up into a nice symplectic form, so it just was a huge pain to try to solve if you didn't have the formalism.
Just one comment on the specialness of the Wigner representation.
Yeah.
If you write out the Wigner representation as trace, so you had the Fourier transform on the board earlier.
Yeah.
But if I take the Fourier transform of those phase displacement operators themselves, I get the phase point operators, and then the Wigner representation is just the trace of the phase point operators.
Right. So you take Fourier transform of this. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so the Wigner is the trace of these phase point operators times the density operator.
Yeah.
And so you can think of those phase. So you can think of that trace form as just the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product.
That's right.
And then you're just picking out a particular basis of the operator space. Right. So you're saying I'm going to represent rho relative to the basis of operators that are the phase point operators.
Yeah, the phase point operators are super duper special, right?
Right, So what's special about them is that if you ask what is the dual basis in the operator space of the phase point operators, it's the phase point operators again. Whereas for other choices of basis, like the ones that would define the two in the Q representation, the dual basis is not the same set of operators. So it's the self-duality of that operator basis that gives it its nice property.
Yep, I believe that. I'm trying to think. I guess my thing is I don't have a good intuition for why dual bases are important. I've heard of them and I've used them before, but I can't remember what the intuition was for.
It just means that if I want to write down the trace of some density operator rho times some measurement operator, and I break it up into trace the density operator with the basis element times the trace of the measurement operator with the dual basis element. then if I have this self-duality, then they both are just traces with a phase point operator. That's why it was okay to write W of O, where O could be a state or a measurement operator. It doesn't matter. It's always the same representation. Whereas in these other cases, if you're thinking of something as a state, you represent it with one function. If you're thinking of that same operator as a measurement operator, then you represent it differently.
Yeah, okay.
Is that something like saying that it's an orthonormal basis and self-dual basis?
It's definitely not
basically
normal.
Not literally normal, but orthogonal or something.
Even if it's not an orthogonal basis, even if I have like a basis of just linearly independent operators, as you would have for things like the key representation, I can still talk about the dual basis of that.
Right, but when you say it's self-dual, is that more or less like saying that it's orthonormal? No.
No.
Well, are all orthonormal bases self-dual?
I guess all orthonormal bases are self-dual,
So it shares that property with orthonormal bases,
Well, okay, so actually I don't know the answer to your question. Maybe the answer is yes.
So it might be that the thing to say is that this is the unique over complete basis that's both self-dual and invariant under phase space translations.
Something like that. I'm not sure. I'm just going based off what the words sound like.
You might want to include not just phase space displacements, but the symplectic transformations as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so if I was going to write
a textbook on quantum mechanics where I wanted to talk about open systems, this would be like the number one, this would be the main thing.
Suppose you have friction, but suppose you have a kind of friction. What's the most general kind of friction you can get? So presumably you could get sort of viscous friction where retarding, the frictional force is proportional to the velocity.
That's right.
Is that the only form, or are there more general?
No, because you know that can't be the only form because that's not symplectic covariant because it prefers momentum to position.
No.
So then I'm trying to think. You know, I think my biggest problem is probably I don't have other forms of intuitive friction at my fingertips. That's the only one I really think about. I think about the damped harmonic oscillator, which spirals down, and I think about normal viscous drag. I don't think you're going to be able to get like complicated dependence on momentum.
I'm just wondering because I mean we're actually going to do an experiment, hopefully soon. Or not me, but
not here in perimeter.
Not in perimeter. Not very close to you. Actually, in Bangalore. So. It could be a little farther, but not too much.
Okay. Yeah, I know.
But with someone who was at IQC. Anyway, but it's based on the. She's not. Never mind. It's not relevant. But she wasn't at IQC. That's a different person in Bangalore. Anyway, the thing is, one can, using fluctuation dissipation theorem, one can show that if the friction is this linear kind of viscous friction, that just like you showed in long time, there's a typical spreading which is proportional to the square root of t, the famous and well-known diffusive spreading. In the quantum case, in short time, you get a kind of logarithmic diffusion, and there's another kind of unique regime. And there's a kind of crossover regime between the two where you get some more complicated kind of diffusion. So now I'm wondering, is that all built into this?
That's a good question.
I want to say, I mean, presumably you can get that. I think it has to be right because this is, presumably you can get that in a kind of a general system. It doesn't require any funny Hamiltonian. Certainly, you can talk about the fluctuation dissipation theorem in this framework. It's closely related to that bound between D and gamma.
But it's an inequality. It's not just
an inequality. It's an inequality, but it's
so when that equality is saturated, the temperature of the environment is zero, right? Because that allows it to cool down to the ground state. And then when it's not, there's a higher temperature, and there's a relationship between, yeah.
But this incorporates the fluctuation, or could
it?
Does it incorporate, because that fluctuation dissipation theorem is based on assuming some sort of Gibbsian distribution state for the environment, or
So
you have to forgive me. So the last time I thought about this was at least 8 months ago. I think there are subtleties there, bound up in the Markov approximation. Basically, you can't treat the environment as thermal, except when the Yeah, the environment can't be perfectly thermal unless D is much greater than gamma, I think.
That has to do with the fact
that... So that would mean you wouldn't get into the quantum. Does that mean you wouldn't?
It might be.
Because
yeah.
I think this pure quantum kind of diffusion, if I can call it that, you could think of it as, just as you think of the Brownian motion as diffusion driven by thermal fluctuations.
Yeah.
Classical. You could, in some sense, think of this quantum diffusion as driven by the uncertainty principle, by quantum fluctuation, diffusion driven by quantum fluctuation. So that sounds like you would want this D to be
small.
Yeah. Small. So.
Yeah, my guess is, yeah, so not, well, I'm not being, you're changing my mind here, so that's clear, I don't know much. So what I want to say is that the problem comes because the Lindblad equation only applies exactly when you can integrate out fast degrees, microscopic degrees of freedom. And it becomes a better and better approximation as those become faster and faster, which means they have to be getting hotter. So I think that may have an issue. Yeah. If you're trying to work downward, D is near gamma, then you won't be able to treat.
This quantum regime is a short time regime. That's another way of saying it.
Yeah.
Sort of told us that maybe.
All right. Thanks, Jess.
All right, thanks.